episode 8 of the VR Hive's Inside Education podcast. In this episode, we're joined by Dr. Nigel Newbert, where we'll be exploring how virtual reality can support neurodiverse individuals.
So welcome, Nigel. How are you doing today?
Very good, thank you, and appreciate you having me on. I'm looking forward to discussing this area with you.
No, we really appreciate your time and taking time out of your schedule to be with us today. So thank you so much. I'm sure our listeners will appreciate that as well. And would you like to say a few words just to introduce yourself?
Yes, sure. So I'm currently a senior lecturer and researcher at the University of the West of England, where I teach into areas around digital education. And my research is also focused around areas of digital education. But very specifically, my work has focused on autistic groups, autistic adults and autistic children, and particularly looking at ways that technologies can bring special affordances to some of those learners and populations. And we've been finding ways to work with those groups to understand better how technologies can support them in their day-to-day lives, really. And very recently, we've been looking at sort of embedding some of those technologies in schools and working within school contexts. So my work has covered sort of VR and virtual environments, and has also sort of strayed across into social robotics as well. So my work is kind of, you know, runs that spectrum, but predominantly my work has been focused around virtual reality technologies.
Yeah, fabulous. I think it's quite a topical issue as virtual reality is starting to grow, and we know that schools and education are starting to experiment and explore it a bit further. So it's a really interesting and important topic as well, I think. So how did you first kind of sort of discover virtual reality, and what kind of inspired you to really hone in on this area?
Well, my work started, so my background, sort of my undergraduate qualification or degree is in sort of digital media technologies, and that was many years ago now. But as part of that degree, in the final year, I worked very closely with hard of hearing communities in Leeds, which is where I studied. And so my final year project was focused on creating some digital technologies and learning opportunities for the deaf community in Leeds. And then I worked in industry for a few years in a hospital, actually developing learning materials in that context. But then I returned to education and teaching, and also did my master's degree in education. And then, having completed that, I pursued a PhD. And really, it was at that point where this sort of convergence of digital technologies and education came together, and looking at what type of benefits that can bring people who are often underserved in the community. I quite quickly found that autistic individuals, and there was a lot of research with autistic groups around technology and education. So my work really at that point sort of latched and focused onto that. But that kind of stems from those. And the reason I mentioned my undergraduate degree and working with the deaf community in these was because all of my work has had this kind of sort of overarching context or underpinning, if you will, of social justice, and looking to find ways that technologies can benefit people who are, like I say, are potentially underserved and can benefit from them. So that sort of PhD project was a convergence of sort of my technical skills coupled with my educational interests, but also coupled with this kind of desire to support underserved groups. And in this particular case, autistic groups came to the fore as people, as where there was already an evidence base growing in this field. And then my work at that point connected with virtual environments. So I was working with virtual world technology in schools, and developing and understanding how autistic people represent themselves actually digitally in a virtual world, but also understanding how they communicated in a virtual world, and how that could bring specific affordances within classrooms. So that's where my work kind of enters this space. And that was back in around about, I mean, we're talking back in, I don't know, 2008, 9, 10 really here. And then as I exited that piece of work, and Oculus Rift became commercially available, or available to researchers, certainly in, 2014, 15, 16. So then my work naturally kind of moved into that space, where I conducted some of the first work actually to really evaluate that technology with autistic people. Wow. And we did that work in the States in 2015-16. So that's kind of how my work has kind of moved from more screen-based media with virtual worlds and environments, and then been brought into that kind of more immersive space of virtual reality headsets as we now know them.
Yeah, so I mean, when we talk about autism and autistic people, I mean, there's a lot of kind of different definitions flying around. I wonder whether you can just sort of nail down a sort of a definition and what kind of what you mean by autistic people from your kind of perception.
Okay, well, that's a good way of asking it, actually, because often there are kind of very formal definitions, you know, which are focused around diagnosis and criteria there in the American Psychiatric Association, for example, and the CDC have, you know, definitions of that. But, you know, for me, it's just, you know, it is officially considered, you know, a neurodevelopmental, you know, condition. Often, you know, it is often seen as a spectrum, you know, condition where people can have associated learning difficulties who have autism. But predominantly, you know, it, you know, autism or being autistic, you know, sort of impacts social communication and behavioral context really of an individual. But for me, you know, it's, you know, everybody's different, you know, we all have differences, I think, in our own ways. And for me, you know, autistic people just represent, you know, somebody who's just slightly different from the norm, I guess. And like I say, some of those issues when with the people we've worked with, especially, you know, can really impact, you know, they can impact language, you know, somebody being able to speak, communicate verbally. It can influence somebody's ability to understand social conventions and social norms, if you will. And obviously people with, in many ways, autistic people will also have sort of repetitive and sort of pattern behaviors or pattern recognition behaviors as well. So those are, you know, the technical sort of context of how somebody with autism may present. But like I say, for me, it's, you know, it's just, you know, it's just that everyone's different, and autistic people are very, you know, specifically different. But I think also for me, you mentioned the terminology there, I think autism and sort of autistic. I think there has been a shift again in this space from sort of medical definitions and medical sort of terminology of these particular groups, moving towards more socially inclusive language and sort of social models of disability. So this isn't about what autistic people can't do because of their disability and the way that they're defined medically, but rather it's how maybe society isn't quite adapted enough to enable autistic people to achieve their potential. So for me, it's, you know, so for me, I'm very much on that social model of disability, whereby I see that there are opportunities to better include and to shift and to change society and how society looks and perceives and works with these communities. And for me, in my research, what that very much sort of picks up on is around participation and making sure autistic people are involved very much in our research, and right the way from formulating research questions with us, right the way through to evaluating research with us, and you know, as a researcher, you know, feeding our work back into those communities. So for me, that's, I don't know if that answers the question completely, Laura, but I think that's kind of, you know, you know, there are these medical definitions of autism that, you know, people look up and will, you know, maybe be aware of. But for me, it's just about, you know, recognizing that people have differences and how can we better shape and shift society, and technologies are part of societies now, and how we can adapt and create technologies with these individuals and with these groups, you know, to best support them and to best support what they want these technologies to do for them. And I think we'll come back to that later when we talk about sort of paradigms in this space. But yeah.
Well, how does virtual reality fit in sort of with autism? I mean, you talked about or made reference to one of the sort of early studies. Can you tell us a bit more about that and how virtual reality was used with autistic individuals and sort of types of impact that it had?
Yeah, I'll give a brief summary if that helps, and do let me know if you want me to go into sort of any more detail. But work with autistic groups and technologies are not that new, but I guess as a research evidence base, they're considered fairly new. I mean, you know, work started off in the 1970s, the late 1970s, with sort of multimedia technologies. And that quickly kind of ramped up with, you know, more immersive technologies, like, as you mentioned, head-mounted displays. And in 1996, there was a kind of a key study that explored autistic acceptance of wearing a head-mounted display. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned about accessibility and people willing or not to wear head-mounted displays. So yeah. There was a study done in 96 that was done in the States. And what they really concluded was that the autistic individuals they worked with, and they were quite young individuals, that they were willing to wear a head-mounted display. And you can imagine in 96, they were a lot bigger, bulkier.
I was going to say, quite huge, compared with sort of the Quest that we know today.
Absolutely, and with the latest HCC sort of set of glasses almost coming out, yeah, back then they were significantly different. So they wanted to test whether or not, I mean, there were only two people in their study, so two autistic people were willing to wear their headset. And then when they wore the headset, were they able to use a virtual environment within that space, sort of a 360 immersive environment? Were they able to safely navigate crossing a road safely? Mm. So that's what they wanted to test. So were these autistic individuals who sometimes can't spot dangerous situations and can often, for example, run out in front of a car, were they able to use this technology to better understand how to, you know, navigate those spaces? And obviously one of the benefits of doing it in a virtual reality space is that it's not real. You're not really going to be hit by a car, but rather you can learn through mistakes without real life consequences. So that was a real kind of perceived benefit of these technologies back in the sort of mid to late 1990s. But those technologies were never really took off. You know, they never really scaled. They remained in research labs. They remained being used in medical and kind of NASA, you know, space exploration and, you know, those sort of military contexts. So they never hit mainstream and they never kind of took off. So research at that time then returned really to screen-based media. And in the early 2000s, we saw a lot of research conducted by Sarah Parsons, who's now at the University of Southampton. But really Sarah Parsons and Sue Cobb as well, who's professor at the University of Nottingham at the moment, they kind of spearheaded some research that kind of looked at using virtual environments, so screen-based technology. And they looked at those technologies and how they could support social skill acquisition, overcoming or better understanding social conventions. And they also wanted to explore kind of the ecological validity of these spaces with these groups. That was kind of like the 2000s, you know, the early 2000s, 2000 to about 2010, we saw a lot of work in that area. But then, as I said, when that also included some of the work that I did and using virtual worlds as a way of collaborating. So research then started to wanted to understand how these technologies could enhance the collaboration skills of autistic people.
I just wonder what some of the findings were, going back to sort of Sarah Parsons' work, and how that kind of, what did that highlight? Did it highlight any sort of accessibility challenges or anything that really worked well, or what autistic people were gaining, what sort of the impact was from that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think firstly, that work really showed a couple of things. First of all, it showed that, again, these technologies proved really beneficial to some of the groups that they worked with. And they worked with younger groups as well. So they were working with children and young adults. And they showed that there was a good fit between this technology. So in other words, they were able to navigate this technology in very similar ways to their typically developing peers. So there was something about this kind of, I don't like the term necessarily, but you know, it was used around that time, kind of leveling the playing field. So there was something about the technology that was quite special in that it made autistic people feel, like I say, on par with their typically developing peers, whereas in the real world, that wasn't always the case. And they also showed that the autistic people they worked with were able to develop specific skills in these virtual environments and then actually apply those in the real world. Wow. And they didn't, you know, there were several limitations around that, around the technicalities of how they sort of found that. And I think it still remains a little bit flaky in many ways, but they were able to show some correlation between what was being learnt in a virtual world, things like social conventions, being able to navigate, going into a coffee shop, you know, and ordering a coffee and doing things in a socially kind of acceptable way. So, you know, and I think since then we have kind of gone away from that notion a bit, but that was what they would finding out then. And they were locating that could kind of generalize into the real world and into, so in other words, the learning that could take place in these spaces was, you know, really quite, there was something quite unique and special for these particular populations that they were working with. And they also showed actually that the quality of the graphics that they were experimenting with at the time were actually not that important. So they worked with some very simple graphics and simple interfaces right the way through to some very immersive interfaces, and they actually found that there wasn't too much of an issue between what level of complexity was provided to the users. But they did also locate that there was also something very special about these interfaces, that they could be modified on the fly, if that makes sense. So they could be modified while the user was using them. We now call that sort of artificial intelligence, don't we? And, you know, and yeah, how that technology can be modified as a learner, you know, using learning analytics, that interfaces can be modified, what we are presented with can be changed and modified and so on. So they were starting to explore and understand that that was a benefit to these particular groups as well. So I think we exited that kind of period of work before we got into the fully immersive virtual reality head-mounted displays, that there was both something very special about these technologies, that they provided authentic training and learning contexts, that they were safe and controllable, that they were, that they could be individualized, and that they could intrinsically reinforce certain things, but also that they could provide this both predictable space that autistic people, again, are attuned to. They're very attuned to things being predictable. And in that context, they could potentially do things in a virtual space that didn't have real world consequences, which would alleviate the sort of pressures that they can experience in the real world. So a lot of those things were kind of discovered in that period of 10 years, you know, 2003 to 2010, wow, 12, really.
That's amazing. And I want to wonder, is there any difference between the impact in terms of using, say, 360 film and using a computer simulated environment?
And so what we have seen, we've seen some research and some companies deploying immersive, you know, graphics and images with autistic groups. We've seen some people using 360 videos with, you know, with those groups. And we don't really have a sense of which is best or worse. And I don't think if we did research in that space that there is any best or worse. It's probably about the best fit for the best situation. And it's also very much, and we'll talk about this later, I'm sure, but it's also very much what people have access to. So immersive VR is very time consuming and very expensive, as you well know, versus 360 video content, which can in some cases be a lot less technically, you know, straining, and it can be a lot less expensive. So you've got one area that can get to market very quickly potentially, and one market which might take a lot more time and cost. So, and some businesses and research are doing one over the other, but I think we don't really know which is best, but we do know that there are different situations where those different things can be applied potentially. But we're not sure which is best, but we do know that following this sort of trend of research with virtual reality technologies right the way through from, you know, 1996 really, when it was first started, what we do know is that there's enough evidence, sort of around about enough evidence, I would say, that these type of interfaces and technologies can benefit sort of outcomes of autistic people. So I think it's more about, and this is where bringing in the autistic voice is very important, because it's not for me to say which is best, and frankly, yeah, it's not even for researchers to say which is best, but it's to work with these end users, you know, if you will, and thinking about what they may find most beneficial to them and why they might find those most beneficial. So I think it's our job next to really start asking the question that you've just asked, probably.
Yeah. And this dovetails quite nicely into one of your latest papers, in which you make mention of participatory technology design. What does that kind of look like?
Yeah, well, I think, so just to kind of take that back a second, if that's okay, I think, yes, really, it's really important to point out, as I said, that this work has been in that time frame that I've talked about, really, from sort of the mid-90s, well, right the way from the 70s, when the technology sort of at large was being used with autistic people, right the way through really to the mid, you know, 2005, 6, 7. A lot of technology was kind of done on autistic people, if that makes sense. So it was kind of a top-down, sort of a top-driven, yeah, you know, so it was driven by researchers, it's driven by, you know, us saying this is what we think is best, now you try it for us and give us some, you know, give us some data, and we'll, you know, we'll decide whether or not it was best for you. And that's really shifted in the last sort of 5 years, not as quick or as much as I would like, but I think what we're now seeing is this kind of bottom-up approach, where hopefully we're seeing this research agenda being co-created with autistic people and their families and caregivers and teachers and stuff, and really wanted to kind of ask them, you know, what the challenges are they face in their lives, how this technology can potentially fit into that, and how we can co-design and develop this for them. And that comes out in a really sort of key report in 2013 by Pelenico, Dinsmore and Charman at University College London at the time, where some quotes that when they surveyed some autistic people, they, you know, I'm just going to read you some quotes that they felt in terms of autistic research was at the time. So one quote was, researchers are more keen on collating data but not providing results. I don't think many researchers feel they can talk to autistic people as if they matter. They're too busy studying them like specimens or looking for a cure.
Gosh.
Somebody else says most of the research centers on high functioning or Asperger's type of autism, it's not relevant to my son's life. And it's important research to have practical outcomes. Researchers need to be closer to those affected by autism. So there was this real kind of picture emerging that there wasn't much inclusion of autistic people. And autistic people, when asked about research done with them, that there wasn't much connection between what we were doing and what some of those communities were looking for. So my kind of sort of take on that really is that the types of technologies we will design and develop in the future will only be successful and beneficial if we involve autistic people. So really, my approach is to sort of build stakeholder sort of involvement in what we're doing right from the outset. And that includes me having an autistic mentor, for example. So not being autistic myself, I feel it's a bit, you know, it's a bit, if you will, a bit weird kind of me coming up with, you know, the ideas of what might be the best here. So I work very closely with an autistic mentor who can kind of check me, if you will, and kind of pull me aside and say, well, no, hang on, hey, you know, think about this or don't think about that, or this is not a way to use those, to do this work maybe. But then even so, from that, working with autistic young people, teachers, parents, carers, asking them about what we might formulate in terms of a research project with them, you know, right the way through then to co-designing the technology with them, testing the technology with them, getting feedback from them in that process. So for me, it's just about participatory design in this context is about continuous engagement with our community right the way through a research sort of process, which can be better informed, it'll be better designed, it will be more accessible. You know, you mentioned that word already, it'll be more accessible, it'll be more in tune to what they're looking to experience, the way that they're looking to experience it. Is it 3D, as you say, is it 360 video versus immersive content? All that stuff will be designed, will come out in that process of kind of co-designing through focus groups and through, you know, questionnaires and through just conversations with and through iterating what we do. So I think that's the approach we've taken. And it's been, you know, I mean, it probably goes without saying, but it's been, you know, incredibly revealing because the assumptions we had are often things that quite quickly get wiped out when we actually work with our communities and ask questions of them. And in a piece of work we did recently with social robotics in a school, you know, we completely missed the mark in terms of what we thought the pupils would want to use a robot in their school for. And when we engaged them in focus groups to understand what they would like to use it for, you know, it was really, that just drove everything that we next did. And it then drove, you know, this successful kind of embedding of this technology in the school. Whereas that would not have happened, and it hasn't been the case because not much research has been successful in the past because they don't approach it in that way.
Have you got any sort of stories of sort of autistic people first sort of being exploring virtuality for the first time and just put the headset on and sort of that jaw dropping moment? Because I personally, when I first tried VR, my jaw dropped. I was like, oh my god, this is amazing. But how do people sort of respond to that kind of on the floor when you're observing them engaging that for the first time?
Cool, good question. I think that's really interesting. I think you're right. It is quite a unique experience for those people who have experienced it. But and having worked now, I've probably worked, you know, with hundreds of autistic young people and young adults and so on. And it's difficult to describe because I think everybody has their own reaction and response to it, probably as your work tells you, Laura. You know, what I would say is that we have only had very, very, very few people who have had an adverse reaction to it, shall we say. The overwhelming response is, you know, it's positive, it's exciting, you'll often hear people laughing, you'll often hear people verbalizing and talking about what they're seeing, what they're doing. With the technology we've used, you're able to physically move around the virtual spaces. So we've had people, you know, moving, walking, you know, crouching or trying to throw things with their handsets if that's what's happening in the virtual world. So with what we've seen is, you know, when you're looking outside in, what you see is people becoming very quickly immersed, people feeling very present in this virtual world because of course their brain is being tricked that they're somewhere else completely, and it really does show. But it shows in a very, like I say, a very positive, you know, a very, you know, communicative and a very, you know, a very funny way, actually. So people often, they exhibit being relaxed, I think, is if I was to summarize it, you know, they exhibit positive behaviours. So therefore, you know, they appear to be quite relaxed and quite enjoying the space and the work.
Is it something sort of when they've had that experience, as they come out of that virtuality headset, do they sort of talk about what they've experienced after? Does it encourage sort of verbal communication as well in sort of the real world? So not just not just the core experience of life skills, if you like, but then coming away from that and being in the real world and actually talk, does it encourage that kind of dialogue?
Yeah, I think we have done that. So we have encouraged them to give us feedback about what they've just experienced and how they felt about it. And naturally, you know, when they take the headset off, they'll give you that feedback, you know, quite quickly and straight away. But we want to sort of probe a bit deeper. But it's funny the thing you mentioned, because one of the things that, mentioned Sarah Parsons in her work in the sort of 2005, 2006, one of the things they did was once they finished using the virtual environment, they actually then went back into the classroom and spent some time with that pupil, asking them about the things you've just mentioned. And that's some of the stuff that we do. So we do return a few hours later to sort of ask them some questions about, so that thing you learned here or that thing you experienced here, how might you apply that now next, in your life or when you go home or, you know, whatever it might be. And so we do start to tease, and that's where we start to connect some of that generalization of what's happened in the virtual to what may happen in the real. So you're right. I think, certainly in schools anyway, and in educational context, VR is just a part of the bigger sort of educational picture. So I wouldn't want your listeners to think that sort of VR is a kind of a plug-in replacement for education at all. And it really isn't. And that's not how, again, by working with our teachers and our autistic pupils, that's definitely not what's come across. But it's part of the ecosystem. So it's part of saying to somebody, look, we're going to go and learn about some historical subject, and we're going to go and visit there now. So we can use VR to visit there, and we're going to come off of VR, and then we're going to talk about what we've seen, and we're going to feed that back into, you know, into that bigger sort of educational picture. So it's not, and the same with whether it be social skills, communication skills, about learning to get on a bus and go to a job interview or whatever stuff we've been, or working in a coffee shop and how they might practice their sort of technical skills of working at, you know, a coffee shop and so on. So all those things that we've done in VR, I've done in the context that it's just a part of that sort of experience for them that they can reflect on. But like I said to you before, I think the comfort in knowing that you can work through some skills and get it wrong, you know, practice, go back, get it wrong, practice, go back, and then, you know, get it the way you want it. And I'm not saying there's a right and the wrong way of doing these things, but just being able to do that without these real life consequences and then have learning experiences through that. So why did that go wrong for you? What did you get? What didn't sit right with you about that interaction that you had? What felt weird about that? And how can we go back and experience it again and come out and talk about it, again?
And so that sounds like a really supportive way of getting someone to develop social skills and to try things. You know, it's the worst thing probably is trying to go into a social space that you've not been to before, a trip to a museum or something, and then the anxiety of getting that wrong, you're stuck there. Ah, what can I do? Is you've got the VR that actually, it allows you to practice that in the safe space, you can explore it, and you've got that support around to discuss, okay, that was really difficult for me, why was it, and then repeat it. I think that's really a nice way, and it brings that learning to life. Instead of
it does,
having
I think
abstract,
it does. I think it does, and I think we know that you know, a lot of young people, I think, I'm not going to say just autistic young people, but, you know, there can be a preference to visual learning for some of these individuals. And so, as you mentioned there, the museum experience, we did just that. You know, the school were going on a science, you know, they had a science week, and they were going to be visiting We the Curious in Bristol, Science Museum here in Bristol. And so we created a virtual reality tour of that, so they could actually visit that virtually in their classrooms or at home. Virtually, they could plan their trip through it. They could imagine what they could see, what they were going to actually see. They could interact with some of the exhibits and learn a bit about them. So they knew what to expect. And there is a lot of that kind of closing that gap for an autistic person who can feel heightened anxiety of visiting somewhere, as you said, they've not been before. So if we can just bridge that gap and say, here's a piece of technology that can hopefully make you feel, you know, you can see what it's going to look like. You can walk through it. You can plan your visit if you want to go that far. And some of them did do that, actually. Then hopefully it just closes that gap. It just reduces that anxiety or that sort of not knowing what they're going to be going into. And we've found from working with, you know, again, our young groups and asking them about how they felt about it, that you know, that in fact was a big, you know, big factor for them. And it's the same for anything. It could be the same for getting on a bus and going somewhere they haven't been. So, you know, now let's build a VR tour, you know, a VR learning experience of, you know, just getting on a bus. What does that look like, feel like? What are the things you have to go through? What are the things you've got to remember to do, you know, to pay, to get on, to sit, to get off, you know, all those things that could provide when you're in a high sense of anxiety, all those things become much more difficult. So doing it in a virtual reality space and testing it and trying it and working it through and absolutely being exposed to it can, you know, can potentially help.
And what do you feel that there is any sort of important accessibility? We did touch on this a little bit before. Any clear accessibility issues that really need to be taken in consideration when technology companies are developing VR, whether it be something around social skills or whether it's a game or whatever it might be? What do you feel is important to highlight it in those kind of spaces to make that accessible?
So accessibility probably means two things in this context. One, it might be, you know, the actual interface, and two, it might be the actual physical device if we're talking about head-mounted displays, of course. So one of the reasons, just to take you back to the work we did in 2015-16, one of the reasons we did that work at that point, one of the key foci of that work was to understand whether or not an autistic person would be willing to wear the headset, wear headphones, and reuse a kind of an Xbox 360 controller to navigate the environments. So we wanted, one of the first things we wanted to know, because nobody had asked this question other than the work in 1996, nobody had asked the question, would this particular population be willing to wear and accept and use this technology without any adverse effect? So we know that autistic people can have sensory concerns. There is one of the diagnosing criteria is about sensory concerns, and that can include physical sensory. It can mean overload to noise and color. So what we wanted to understand was, you know, hey, let's not use this technology if it's going to be a problem. Let's first ask if it is going to be, you know, a right fit. And what we found was, and so that's one of the main accessibility concerns I have for this technology is somebody with sensory issues and heightened sort of sensory issues as well with light, sound, noises, and so on. Is this the right type of interface for them? And I think, you know, we've concluded that, you know, yes, you know, in many ways we didn't find any issues, you know, with this technology yet in that regard. However, that doesn't mean that there won't be issues around accessibility when we're designing content, to be aware that we may have to build things in that can reduce noise levels or can reduce brightness levels, and there may have to be some special features designed for this special population potentially to help facilitate that. So in other words, we don't throw them into a very bright noisy space straight away, but we start them with a very sort of low stimulus level and maybe bring them up into a heightened sort of level or to a more typical level. Because, you know, that's one of the things that you've probably heard of, these sort of autism friendly shopping hours or autism friendly theatre productions. And the context there essentially is that all the noise and the light levels are brought down essentially. And so I think we could do the same in this sort of technology. So I think we need to be aware of that, especially because we do know that this is quite a, autistic people, you know, can represent across, you know, it is called a spectrum condition. And while we've moved away from that now, you know, an autistic person is an autistic person, you know, and that's it. But there may be other sort of comorbidities, as we sometimes call it, or sometimes other learning associated learning difficulties with that. So I think we just need to be sort of aware of that and think about how we build interfaces. I think the hardware in itself now is quite advanced enough, but these populations would enjoy them. But I think the next step really is to think about how we can design interfaces that will make sure it can sort of tap into their, you know, their special preferences, if you will.
Absolutely. I mean, I've done work with autistic people, you know, in health and social care. And I think sort of more people which are on the lower end, lower functioning, we're talking old language now, so hopefully I've not offended anybody. And I think, just thinking of one individual, perhaps a headset wouldn't work for them, but having something that was just accessible, you know, on a screen, on a tablet, would have, because, you know, they're there with the tablet repeating, that could be quite a nice way. So we need to probably think, would you agree, thinking about designing so it's across different modalities as well?
I think that's always going to be good practice. I mean, in an ideal world, you know, and I think that also taps into the sort of cost of some of these technologies, you know, as well. You know, we, you know, the word digital divide is, you know, something that's, you know, not old hat now, but, you know, it's been discussed for a long time. And I think, you know, there's something still in that. You know, if these technologies are proposed to benefit or to have some sort of, you know, key interest for these, you know, this population, we need to make sure it's accessible, i.e. across a range of devices, as possible. So I would completely agree with that. I think it's just worth sort of drawing out for your listeners that there is something quite different actually with both the screen-based stuff. So you mentioned using an iPad or a screen or whatever it might be, versus using a head-mounted display. There is just something quite different when you step into that sort of head-mounted display content and that sort of hyper sense of reality and presence and immersion that is felt in those spaces. The proposition is that it's, that in itself is something that's so powerful that can really bring some additional benefit beyond the screen-based kind of content that has gone before. And although that's not tested or proven per se, I think there is something just to bear in mind. We should be looking to make it as accessible as possible, but there's something also very special in this kind of head-mounted display space where we need to sort of capture that special nature of immersion and so on, and that sort of things it may be able to do for this population. So I obviously, all of those things you mentioned are important, that we have this as many interfaces across as many different type of devices as possible for people to access, and that is important.
Are there, have you got any kind of sort of tips to support technology companies to access autistic populations, bring them into that kind of design process in some way? Because sometimes that can be a challenge just to know who to reach out to and how to get that engagement.
Yeah, I think that is a kind of like a wicked problem, if you will. And I think it's a problem. I think it's a problem for the companies, really. And it's a challenge for the companies. And it's both a challenge and a problem that they need to address and overcome. I think it's, from what we've seen, there's very little point trying to design these technologies for these particular groups without their input. I think that's shown to be the case. And a lot of the companies we actually see starting up are companies who have been founded on the basis that they've been founded by a parent of somebody with an autistic child. So, they know the very specific issues that they've faced and encountered, and their business and their company have been sort of built on that basis, that they're kind of plugging some of those issues. And those issues are not just for their own child, but they actually expand across into the community, in a larger way. But look, there's no simple answer to that. I think companies need to work hard. What they definitely need to do, which is what sometimes as researchers we don't do for various reasons, I won't go into the detail, but paying and recognizing the input of these participants or these co-designers, call them what we will, but they have to recognize them and then recognize them through paying them for their consulting services. And that's what it essentially is. It's consulting people, and that should come with payment. And again, we're not very good in research at that for reasons of ethics. We can't be seen to be paying people for that, always necessarily. So we find other ways to hopefully make it worth their while. But how do you make it worth their while? What are you paying them? How are you paying them? What sort of contracts are you giving them? All those sort of questions. But before even all of that, you've just got to recognize that these are voices we need in this design and in our business. And when you couple the fact that autistic people there have been companies set up that align autistic people with technology companies. So because there's a very special nature that some of the way autistic people think can really bring benefits to some of those companies. So when you couple the special nature of autistic people can have very unique benefits to technology companies, coupled with, as you said, this sort of growing and expanded market of VR, then you would beg the question why you're not looking to actively employ people with autism in your company if you're working within VR. That's a question I would have. And I think it's about, because I think it's about bringing a diversity to your workforce. Why wouldn't you want people with a range of different abilities to bring to bear different perspectives on what you're doing and designing and the way you're making it? It will just enrich your products and enrich your marketplace, I would have thought, and where you and the sort of markets you can target. So, my call would be you should be looking to expand your workforce into those sort of different neurodiverse communities that can really bring about key benefits, both for what you design and how you design. And I think that for me would be the gauntlet that I'd kind of throw down, really, and to make sure that they, as I say, reward and pay these people, appropriately. And even if they just want them to consult, that they make sure they find ways to do that. So the gauntlet is down at their door, really, to be doing more of that, I think. And as researchers, we can certainly support, we have networks and we have ways of supporting that and putting together groups who guide the work I do as well, which are made up of autistic people as well as others. So, it's, you know, so do they have autistic people and neurodiverse people on their board of governors, you know, board of trustees or governors or whichever organization they have, for example, you know, those sort of things would be important to consider and to actively be considering, you know, not just assume that those things will happen, but actively be promoting that.
Yeah.
Well, sorry to be going, that's probably a long answer question, but there's a lot in there, Laura, there's a lot in there.
It's been really, really insightful and just conscious of time and then, you know, you need to get off. So I just wanted to thank you so much for taking time out. And it's been such an interesting and thought-provoking podcast and lots of nuggets in there for companies to think about and really apply that within VR development. So thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
If you like what you've heard and you want to find out more about the VR Hive, why not visit our website at www.thevrhive.com? Bye for now.